getting used to having a shadow. I had no real interest in speaking to Sloane, but if Pars had seen him leaving unimpeded, I'd probably end up on a hospital ward myself. The conference space and interview rooms had a bland, mass-produced, modern aesthetic. If Hitler's bunker had been designed by Travelodge, it couldn't have communicated quiet despair any more effectively. Sloane slouched in his seat and twisted a little finger in his ear, like he was winding himself up. He had the build of a tree stump, and a dissatisfied crease for a mouth. "So," he said, drumming the desk with knuckleless hands, "what can I do you for?" "We'd like to talk about the picture of Martin Wick you printed in your Sunday edition." "The Mail printed in their Sunday edition," he said, correcting me. "With your byline beneath it." "Nothing escapes you lot, does it?" he said with a smile. "Except protected prisoners." "I'm not sure Martin Wick would describe his agonizing death as a jailbreak, Charlie." "And I'm not sure who I'm speaking to," he said, folding his arms. They were so short that he had to grip on with both hands to keep them together. "I'm Detective Sergeant Waits, and this is..." "Waits," he said. "The avant-garde himself." "You were there. Or supposed to be." "That wasn't a part of the public record, so I won't ask who told you. You can appreciate why I'd like to know who took that picture, though." "Well, from what I understand, aside from Wick, there were only three people present. Two of whom had the air let out of them." He looked at Naomi. "Whoever smelt it, dealt it, I say. You should arrest this man." She smiled. "You won't tell us who sold you the picture, Charlie?" "I protect my sources." "Your headline doesn't even work," she said. "Wick wasn't a serial killer." "That you know of." "Kevin Blake's book acknowledged it as a possibility and, as I told the Dark Lord out there, people had a right to know their babies were being born in the same building where he was filling a bedpan." "Would you rather he went on the floor?" she asked. "I'd rather he died in jail, as planned." "He was sentenced to life," she said. "Not death." "Well, more's the pity." Naomi started to respond, but he interrupted her. "Nah, I'm not finished, young lady. If I talk to someone about this, it'll be one of the grown-ups. Someone who can give me something back for my trouble. Chief Inspector James has got this case, from what I understand."
"We're following supplementary lines of inquiry," said Naomi.
"Your chief super wasn't interested in the most promising one."
"Which is?"
He reached into his pocket and showed us his phone. A picture of the missing former detective constable, Tessa Klein. She was dressed up for a night out, wearing a black dress and an eye-popping pink handbag. It seemed likely that she and I had passed each other in a corridor or two, but I couldn't recall ever meeting her.
"What do you think she's got to do with this?"
"According to my information, she graduated in the same year as Rennick."
"So did I," said Naomi. "I never met him. Why would a 6-month-old suicide be linked to what happened on Saturday?" Sloane shrugged.
"Why did she book a weekend break for two and then top herself? Why did you never find the body?"
"Because she wasn't thinking rationally," said Naomi. "The body? It'll turn up, Charlie. They always do."
"I'm sorry," he said.
"What was your name again, darling?"
"Constable Black."
"Well, give us a minute, eh, Constable Black?"
She looked at me, then got up and left, doing a good job of seeming unfazed. I didn't have the same grace, and as soon as the door closed, I leaned forward.
"Well?"
"Well what?"
"Well, what do you have to tell me?"
"Tell you?"
He laughed again.
"Nah, boy." He nodded after Naomi. "I was just enjoying the front of Black Beauty so much, I couldn't wait to see the back of her. You're still young. If I were you, I'd try and find a way to give her a bit of the old nightstick."
I got up and went to the door. I'd been hoping for an ambling conversation that went nowhere, so I could creep out of the building without Naomi following. But nothing was worth this.
"Hang on a sec," he said.
I turned.
"You do know, don't you?"
"Know what?"
This play-acting, this fancy-dress pomps police work you think you're doing, this shadow investigation you've got going on.
I waited.
You're just a fresh pair of pants, boy. When the time comes, they'll hang you out to dry. Here's hoping there's no shit stains in your kecks, eh?
I could think of a few things to say in return, but instead I crossed the room, pulled him onto his feet, and projected him through the door.
Thanks for your help.
Naomi was standing outside, wide-eyed at my rough handling of an interviewee. If she put it in her report to pass, it was one of the few things he might pat me on the back for. Sloane was used to it anyway, and it seemed to shake something loose. He checked his watch and sucked on his teeth.
Getting on for 9:30.
That's right, I said. Shouldn't you be hiding outside some school gates or something? He laughed.
You know, the real detective, the man who actually caught Martin Wick, is about to go on the radio and talk all about it.
He saw the look on my face.
And I'm betting you haven't got around to him yet. You should have a word, one of these days. Might learn a thing or two.
Chapter 4
"Excuse me," said the security guard. "You can't go in there."
We were in the lobby of Key House, BBC headquarters in Media City. We badged the guard and asked to be escorted into the studios. Media City is a 200-acre property development on the banks of the Manchester Ship Canal. What had been a barren wilderness of industrial decline just over a decade before was now a sprawling new media complex worth more than $1 billion. Across 7 monolithic facilities, it housed television networks, content creators, radio stations, and more. The largest of these buildings, Key House, was home to the BBC. It was a 7-story glass structure and towered over the canal like some prehistoric glacier that had drifted in on the tide. Stepping into the atrium at its center was overwhelming, and craning your neck you could see each of the 5 floors above. It felt like standing at the center of an improbably empty Olympic stadium. The security guard led us up, past open-plan offices, meeting areas and breakout spaces. We reached the broadcast facilities too late. A large pane of glass walled off the studio where Kevin Blake was already being interviewed about Martin Wick's death. The audio was being broadcast out to the floor and to the nation. The presenter glanced at us through the glass.
"For those just joining us this morning, we've been speaking to Kevin Blake, the former detective inspector who secured a conviction against Martin Wick. He's also the author of the best-selling book The Sleepwalker, which examines the case. Kevin," she said, "it's your belief that Saturday night's attack was premeditated."
Blake nodded.
"The killer neutralized 2 police officers, carried out the execution of a protected prisoner, and managed to get away with it. Now, that doesn't happen by accident."
Blake was somewhere in his early 60s. And better groomed than any former DI I'd ever seen. No spider legs of nasal hair or burst capillaries for him. It was smart, dark suits all the way, and they had the effect of making his skin seem even paler than it already was. The thin, brass-rimmed glasses felt like an affectation, making him look like a pre-war intellectual. I didn't think he was vain necessarily, just a man who'd expected to be noticed. He had a broad Yorkshire accent, and it sounded honest against the received pronunciation of a BBC presenter.
"Final question," said the host. "We know that a woman in or around her 30s with facial tattoos is being sought in connection with this attack. Are there any further details on her?"
"Not according to what I'm hearing. Although, once more, I must stress that I am not part of this investigation. Anyone with information relating to this attack should get in touch with the proper authorities. My sources do indicate that this woman is a significant person of interest, but I think Chief Superintendent Chase's press briefing this morning told us far more than that."
For those who didn't hear this morning's briefing, the Chief Superintendent advised members of the public not to approach this woman, as she is considered extremely dangerous.
"In fact, she went further," said Blake, holding the presenter's gaze.
when questioned on public safety surrounding this attack, and on the person of interest still at large, the chief superintendent all but said that she wouldn't hesitate to approve lethal force in her apprehension. He let that sink in for a second. As you know, that's extraordinary language, Miranda, usually reserved for acts of domestic terrorism.
Extraordinary, indeed. You mentioned domestic terrorism. Do you believe that the public are safe in the wake of this attack?
Blake considered this. Martin Wick was a one-of-a-kind target, believe you me. Whoever killed him likely felt they had a strong motive for doing so. I'd be surprised to see any similar attacks. That said, this is one dangerous individual, and I'd echo the Chief Superintendent's warning to give them a very wide berth.
Kevin Blake, thank you. The presenter wrapped up the broadcast and they both removed their headsets. Behind the glass window, we couldn't hear what was being said off mic, but they had a brief conversation before Blake gave her a meaningful two-handed handshake. He got up, opened the door, and stepped out of the booth. To avoid any possible confusion about his identity, he carried a copy of his own book.
"Kevin Blake," said Naomi, stepping forward. "I'm DC Black, and this is my colleague, DS Waits. We've been trying to get hold of you."
"You and the rest of the world," he said. The way his lenses caught the light meant that I couldn't see his eyes. And I couldn't tell if he sounded arrogant of the attention or weary of it.
Chapter 5 Blake led us into the coffee shop over the road, motioned us each to a seat and then sat opposite, sliding a menu out of our sightline, ordering coffee and water to the table. I could have almost believed he was there to interview us. He placed the copy of his book face down, so that the author photo was staring up. In the picture, Blake's jawline looked a little firmer, but it was the same honest, open face. The book had been successful enough for him to launch a career, making press appearances, pontificating on notorious killers, as well as fulfilling more general rent-a-quote duties. Though he'd retired soon after the case that had made his name, he was still well-regarded in police circles, maintaining the public image of a man on the inside, despite having been a civilian for the past decade. The waitress brought three coffees, some water, and his change to the table. When she left, he drew a cup towards him and smelt it.
"I'm not allowed coffee anymore, but I still get a kind of contact eye from the fumes." "Does it keep you up?" I said. He laughed. "Might put me down for good. Heart problems, unfortunately. I don't ever get old." "I'm sorry," he said. "Your name was..."
"Waits."
"You were on the scene, if I heard correctly."
"You're well informed," I said. If he still had sources on the police force, then he'd heard a lot more about me than that.
"Sorry," he said. "After 20 years on the beat, I think it's just boiled into me. I try and keep my finger on the pulse, especially when it comes to Martin. I was bloody sorry to hear about Detective Inspector Sutcliffe." "Of course. You must have worked together." "You were his partner," said Blake. I nodded. "Then you probably know Sutty could be a bit..." I nodded again. "You might know, or you might not, but I had Sutty taken off the original case. All I know is he was the first on the scene. And he wasn't without his talents. I just thought they'd be better used elsewhere."
"How did he take it?"
"You don't know this? He handed in his notice." I was surprised. I couldn't imagine Sutty being invested enough in anything to react so strongly. "Someone must have talked him down from the ledge, though, because the next thing I knew, he was on the night shift."
"It's all news to me," I said, realizing that a man who'd been retired for more than a decade knew my partner better than I did. I wondered if that was Sutty's fault or mine.
"Who's got you running round after this?" said Blake.
Superintendent Pars.
"The Greyhound himself, eh? Good man. You must give him my best. I'm sure he'll be expecting yours. I've never worked with Alistair directly, but my impression is, he's always willing to lend a hand.
It's just that his grip can be a bit firm.
Well put, said Blake, recognizing that he'd focused on me for too long.
Black, he said, turning to Naomi. Now, you wouldn't be related to a Constable Teddy Black, would you?
He's my dad.
You're kidding, he said, slapping a hand on the table.
Then we've met before. I was at your christening.
I hadn't known that Naomi's father had been a police officer, and when I risked a look, I saw she was blushing, making the freckles visible against her dark skin. Blake noticed this as well.
Nothing ages a man like a long memory, eh?
We're counting on that memory, I said.
Both Naomi and I are relatively new to the world of Martin Wick. In light of the events at St. Mary's, we were hoping for some background on the case.
I don't envy you, he said, working out who killed him.
He swept his change off the table, sifting it in his hand.
First thing you should know is, if I threw this over my shoulder, I'd probably hit someone who wanted Wick dead.
If you could hit the killer, we'd be grateful, I said.
No one laughed, and Naomi leaned in. We know he was a hate figure for the tabloids, but we're more interested in people with real-world connections, real-world grudges, people who might actually go through with something like this. The statistical likelihood is that Martin Wick knew his killer, so it makes sense to start with those closest to him.
Of course, said Blake, although it's worth remembering that those closest to him for the last 12 years have been his cellmates. From what I hear, there was no shortage of blokes in there who felt like pulling the flush.
Handily for us, most of them are still serving their own life sentences in strange ways.
Most, said Blake.
One of his attackers is out on license, said Naomi, repeating what we'd heard in the briefing.
Of course, he said. That spy stealer. Blake squinted, trying to remember the details. Short back and sides, I think they called him.
Why's that? Asked Naomi.
Not sure if I want to ruin the surprise, but it won't shock you to hear he's the scum of the earth.
You've had dealings with him?
Happily not. He's a kid, long after my time. Only went into Strangeways last year, and came out a few months back. I've just tried to stay up to date with Martin's play pals over the years. If I remember rightly, this short back and sides bloke tried to hang him in his cell with the bedsheets.
Naomi shook her head. Sounds like short back and sides should be in prison.
Or 6 feet under one. His conviction was overturned, if you can believe that.
All these death threats and acts of violence against Wick, I said. I've always wondered why he got it so bad inside. Naomi looked at me. He killed 3 children.
He's right, though, said Blake. In strange ways, who hasn't? They could fire a child killer out of a cannon every day of the year and still have some time left for Christmas.
Is it the sleepwalking thing? I said. His denial. Not facing up to what he did. Blake shrugged.
There might be something in that, going inside with these guys who are all pretty upfront about what they've done, and then playing innocent, or saying you don't remember. It's always going to rub them the wrong way. I think there's more, though.
He thought for a second.
Well, he was weird.
Weird? Said Naomi.
I don't like it, but there it is. Look around the schoolyard and you can see at a glance who'll be getting their head flushed down the shitter from day one. I'd have put me mortgage on Wick having an hard time inside, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, I said. I didn't disagree. But my experience of older officers was that they usually took a hard line and then doubled it.
A campaign like that, unchecked, in what's supposed to be a high security institution.
Blake affected a pained expression.
That's the opposite of what we should be striving for. And as for some of the other blokes who've attacked him inside, I nodded.
But as we say, these men are easily eliminated.
That's right, said Blake. You want the background.
You were the senior detective inspector on N Division when the original call came in. He nodded.
I can't tell if it's because I spend so much time stewing on it now, or if I had a premonition back in the day. But I always say that was the year the worm turned. Turned. Or the bubble burst, went sour, whatever. You had the mortgage crisis, recession, foreclosure, all that, then Iraq going south, and the launch of the iPhone. The start of all this social media shit. Loss of nuance and attention spans. He shook his head. For me, that's the year the pilot light went out in us. We lost our spark. He rubbed the bridge of his nose and smiled, self-effacingly. I lost mine at any rate. Yes, I was the senior officer on N, but my first interaction with the case came when Wick was brought into Chester House, covered in blood. Clearly, it was serious, but at first we struggled to get any sense out of him. What sort of state was he in? Agitated, confused. When we questioned him about the bloodstains on his person, he said he couldn't remember how they got there, and you probably know. He was such a mess that we had to move carefully. He was shivering, talking gibberish, in shock. That must have been frustrating. Ordinarily, it would have been. But a girl in dispatch connected his description with a suspicious persons report from 11 Briars Green, the Moore's property. There was plenty for us to do there, believe me.
Could you describe the scene?
I wish I could forget it. Semi-detached house at the end of a cul-de-sac. Neighbours slept through the lot, somehow. Front door was wide open when we arrived and Maggie... He stopped, took a drink of water and continued. Margaret, the mother, was lying at the bottom of the stairs. There was a lot of blood, stab wounds to the abdomen and chest, defensive wounds on her hands and arms. We concluded that she'd fought her attacker, tried to prevent him from getting to the kids. We found them upstairs, the twins. They were both in the bath. They'd got in and hid behind the shower curtain, but... Say no more, I said. When did it become clear that the eldest was missing? We were looking at the pictures on the walls, he said. It was always five of them in every frame. Maggie, the mother. Arthur and Mary, the twins. Frank, their dad. And then Lizzie, the eldest. Of course, our immediate focus became locating Frank and Lizzie. The only two not at the house. He nodded at the memory. There was an hour, a good hour there, where I convinced myself they'd be safe, together somewhere. My daughter was her age, 12 at the time, and I don't mind telling you I called the wife and told her to give our Lucy a hug. It was a moving addendum. One I remembered word for word, from several different interviews he'd given over the years. I didn't doubt its sincerity, though. It was the kind of detail you only put into words once and never tinker with again afterwards.
When did you realise Lizzie was among the victims? Asked Naomi.
Unofficially. We found Frank Moore, the father, and he hadn't seen her. The neighbours had already told us Frank and Maggie were... He searched for the right phrase.
Semi-detached? Naomi suggested.
Something like that, he nodded. A trial separation, I suppose you'd call it. He'd moved out, and it was her weekend to take the kids, so he'd been working.
What was his reaction?
What do you think? There are some parts of the job I'll never miss, and that's one of them. I mean, he just fell apart. He's a big man, physically and mentally. Was in the Marines at one time. It was like seeing a building come down, or a landslide. Hard to watch. He kept saying, I should have been there. I should have been there.
And when did you officially know that Lizzie was among the dead?
Well, we never recovered the body, but DNA at the scene clarified things. From what we understand, there was plenty of it. A bloodbath, he said, looking into his coffee. Quite literally.
I was starting to get some idea of why he'd taken early retirement, and why, perhaps, he still felt some responsibility to the victims all these years later. A mute killer, a missing girl, a mother torn apart trying to save her children. The kind of case you could get lost in.
What took Wick there, do you think? Why them?
Madness, said Blake, shaking his head. He was travelling a lot at the time, staying in cheap hotels at B&Bs. Some asbestos job had brought him into the area, and he was at an inn nearby, the White Swan. It was our theory that he fixated on Lizzie, the eldest. Parents said later they'd seen a man matching Wick's description hanging round at her school. We also found some of her clothes in his hotel room and, of course, finally the murder weapon. It was the kitchen knife from the Moore's house, I said, dredging up the memory. Found behind the radiator in Wick's room, on our third or fourth time round. So the full sequence of events was... Wick arrives in the area for work a week before the murders. He sees Lizzie, the eldest, on the street somewhere and follows her, either to school or home, that first time, just so he had some means of finding her again. We had witnesses who could place him at both later on. He stalked her, became infatuated, maybe even made contact or imagined they were in love. One night, he snaps, has to have her. Breaks in the back window, murders Maggie at the bottom of the stairs, butchers the twins in the bath, and snatches Lizzie. We were able to track his movements through the house, because he cut himself breaking in through the back window, trailed blood from the kitchen to the staircase to the bathroom, then back down and out of the front door. Then he drove into town and walked into Piccadilly Station, where he was apprehended. 5 different blood types on his clothes. His own, Maggie's, Arthur and Mary's, and, of course, Lizzie's. Unfortunately, we were certain she was bleeding when she left the house. What happened to her body? That's the great mystery. I know they'd hoped he'd spill the beans to Inspector Sutcliffe, but I never saw it happening myself. I suppose now we'll never know. Poor Frank, eh? I nodded. I wasn't sure what had become of Frank Moore, but we'd have to speak to him. Was there anything like this in Wick's past? I asked. No criminal record, but with regards to his behaviour, it was difficult to get any kind of clear picture.
Because he was a loner, said Naomi.
Blake nodded. And afterwards people weren't exactly crawling out of the woodwork to admit knowing him. His work had him moving around a lot. He cleared off asbestos, but as a freelance contractor. Job like that was perfect for a nomadic, lonely life, and that's what he seemed to be after. Until he saw Lizzie Moore, that is. I interviewed some of the guys he worked with more regularly, but it was all pretty weak beer. Quiet. Kept to himself.
So there was never any suggestion he'd killed before?
Personally? I never discounted it. There were unresolved missing persons cases in the area, similar-looking girls, but we could never definitively say whether he was involved or not. All that moving around and so few people in his life.
What about his family?
Only child, parents dead. There's the ex-wife, of course. I looked up and Naomi stopped writing.
Ex-wife?
We said at the same time. Married, less than a year. Divorced before the murders. Not much to say, but I might have her number somewhere. That would be a big help.
You said Frank Moore came apart, said Naomi.
But he put himself back together again. We actually spoke this morning. We're involved with some of the same charities.
May I ask what the substance of your conversation was? She said.
You're asking if he was happy to see Martin Wick get cremated? He wouldn't be part of the human race otherwise.
We'll need his details too.
By all means. You should try and catch his talk today. I think it's still going ahead.
His talk? I said.
He gives these motivational speeches, I suppose you'd call them, survival seminars, to take all that trauma and turn it into anything remotely positive. It's impressive work. Sheer force of fucking will, pardon the French. Naomi made a note.
Did you ever have any contact or correspondence with Wick after his conviction?
Blake shook his head.
The publisher suggested we do an interview with him for the book, give his side of the story, but I objected. Anyway, like I said, he wasn't exactly talkative. And there was that whole business of him disavowing the confession he finally did sign.
Did you ever believe him? She asked.
Believe him about what?
That he couldn't recall the crime. He considered this for a moment and turned to me.
You must have met him, Waits. What did you think?
Something certainly slipped his mind.
My conclusion too, said Blake. It took a long time for him to come around to signing his confession in the first place, dropping all that sleepwalking business, but he got there in the end.
I didn't want to tell him that Wick's final words had been to forcefully withdraw that confession, but I did want to push him on the subject. So you never had any doubts?
I wouldn't say that exactly. I had some reluctance committing to him as the perpetrator. The way he held himself back, you sometimes had to be mindful of projecting things. He had those big, black eyes, and didn't show much emotion, so it was easy to attribute things to him. I had to keep in mind that we might be filling him up like a pint glass. A lot of the lads hated him, from the off. Sounds tricky. He nodded. And especially because on the other hand, I had to follow me instincts, and all of them were screaming that Wick was my man. All the evidence, too. You'd always gather in evidence, even when you don't know it. Sometimes, what's called intuition is actually your subconscious coming to a logical conclusion sooner than the part of you that second-guesses everything. For what it's worth, my advice is follow your instincts.
Where would you be looking? I said.
For Wick's killer? Revenge seems like the most obvious reason for his death. But what slows you down are the rules of the road.
Second-guessing yourself because your brain's looking for logic.
You think that? Surely anyone who'd kill a murderer wouldn't take down an innocent policeman with him. Wouldn't set fire to another one while he was at it. He looked between us. My real advice is not to go chasing a case like this looking for logic. You'll never sleep again. Murder's not rational, except for the killer. For someone, what happened on that ward felt like the only possible course of action. That's who I'd be looking for.
Chapter 6 And that was me, said Frank Moore.
We were standing at the back of the event space in the Radisson Hotel, inside the Free Trade Hall. Moore was concluding an hour-long speech on the subject of surviving grief. He was the father of three murdered children and the husband of a murdered wife. I thought if anyone had the answer, it was probably him. We'd arrived late and found there were a couple of hundred people in attendance, in a space that would usually host weddings or charity functions. Most were smartly dressed, well-to-do people, prepared to pay the admission fee, comfortable with an afternoon out of the office. Looking more closely, though, the links were apparent. Exhausted faces and red eyes. Scanning the crowd, you could see the burnouts, restless people, itching inside their skin. Some carried the recognizable scars of grief. Gaunt, haunted faces. Drinkers' noses or delirium tremens. Eating disorders and self-harming scars. Others hid them behind designer clothes and well-exercised gym memberships. All of them watched Frank Moore closely, like he was their last hope. It was easy to see why. He was strong, handsome, a full 6'4" of self-assurance, wearing a crisp, fitted shirt over a well-developed chest. The look was completed with blue slacks and cream loafers, but he made the clothes look somehow more like a uniform than a personal choice. Perhaps an echo of his military days. His hair was black, buzzed short, in a high and tight style, with a lightning bolt shock of white straight through the center. He was unnervingly symmetrical, like a Photoshop picture of himself, and in his comfortable persona and easy-speaking manner, in his certainty,
He reminded me of a good barrister making his closing argument in court.
I was living through these photo albums, he said to the crowd. I was dwelling on the past, because I didn't have a future. And that was when I did the most difficult thing of all. I turned the page. And where I'd been looking at this family that I'd been in charge of, my girls, my little lad, a wife I was supposed to protect. On that next page, I saw something else. He looked up at the crowd significantly. I saw myself. See, I'd forgotten that I was in there too. I'd forgotten I was in that photo album. And I'd forgotten I was in that family. I'd forgotten that I loved that man once, as well. He flipped the picture of the Moore family on an A-frame behind him, revealing a close-up of his own face. It was one of those bankers we've been talking about. One of those moments of good feeling that you want to bottle up. To try and future-proof yourself against grief. Understanding nods throughout the room. But grief's a bit like a debt collector, isn't he? Always turns up at the worst possible moment, always takes a bit more than you can afford to give. If bereavement of some kind's found you already, then you'll understand what we've been talking about this afternoon. If it hasn't touched you yet, then I'm afraid that one day it will. Because the books tell us there are 5 stages. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. He looked around the room and then shook his head. The books are wrong, though, because there's actually just the one. William Shakespeare said, "All the world's a stage." I say all the world's a stage of grief. So how do we relearn our lines? How do we go out there and perform again? He looked at the crowd, and for a moment I thought he might actually have the answer. I hope you'll all join me next time to find out. He stepped down from the stage to a standing ovation, ran a hand through the shock of white in his hair, and walked through the center of the room to the exit. I couldn't believe this was the conclusion of his speech. It felt too much like the night shift to be funny. A dealer giving his customers their first taste cheap, then jacking up the price once they were hooked. When Naomi and I followed him outside, Frank had taken up position at a large signing table covered in leaflets, flyers, and promotional materials. We were first in line, but people were already flooding out of the ballroom behind us. I approached the table. That was a powerful speech. He seemed to consider this, as though I'd said something that hadn't occurred to him before. Thank you, he said, after a pause. You've lost someone recently. Quite recently. You arrived late, he said. It's okay. But I don't think you got the full breakdown of what we can offer. You'd probably both benefit from one of our 4-week survival courses. He looked past us at the growing line. We'll discuss my story and you'll have the opportunity to share your own. There'll also be input from some of our other long-term survivors. And what is your story? I said. I think you know my story, officer. He threw in a smile. As you can see, I'll probably have my hands full for the next couple of hours, but we could arrange a meeting for later today. I'd be more than happy to discuss it then. I'm sorry, we didn't mean to. He shook his head. I'm flattered that you're interested in the program. And I meant what I said. I think you'd both get a lot out of it. A lot of cops do.
How much is the program, out of interest? Asked Naomi.
We've got a variety of plans, something to suit all income levels. If you need help, then by hook or by crook we'll make it work.
Did Kevin Blake call ahead to say we were coming?
Kevin? No. You just look like a police officer, Mrs...
Detective Constable Black, she said, with a smile.
I glanced at the growing line. We could visit you later today, at home, or wherever's convenient. I'd like that, he said, standing to shake my hand, but not Naomi's.
He passed me his card, and we stepped out of the line.
Chapter 7
"Do you think he'll speak to us?" said Naomi, as we returned to the car.
"I don't think he was ducking it. If you've got something else on later, I can easily talk to him alone." I knew I was chancing my arm. But if I was ever going to abandon this case and blow town, then at some point I needed to shake Naomi off it.
"Is that what you'd prefer?" she said, after a beat.
I'd almost have preferred to be working the case with Sooty. Superintendent Pars had always made our dynamic clear. One of us to carry the casket, and one of us to carry the can. He didn't care which one of us did what. With Naomi, I didn't know what her role was, what she was carrying. It might have been an olive branch. It might have been a wire. It had been interesting to see Frank Moore bristle at her, though.
"As long as we're looking into this, it might make more sense to attack it from different angles," I said. "I don't know what both of us being here adds to anything."
She was quiet for a moment.
"What did you make of the super's theory that you might have been the intended target of the attack?"
"I'm sorry?" She looked guilty, like she wasn't supposed to know.
"When we were on the roof with Superintendent Pars after Wicks's murder, he said we should look into that possibility. It seems like the only angle that we're not..."
"I don't think it was a serious concern," I said. She didn't respond. "If there's anything else on your mind..." I knew that Naomi had questions about me, that she must have seen her share of scandalous graffiti with my name attached to it. I hoped that if I asked her straight, she'd back down. It didn't work.
"Pars said this man who wanted you dead was an old friend of yours. Who was it?"
"It was a figure of speech," I said, grateful that we were nearing the car. "A figment of his imagination.
You don't trust me, do you?"
I could feel her eyes on me, but didn't look up as I opened the door. "Should I?" She didn't answer. And when we climbed into the car, I thought I could see her mind working, approaching the problem differently. Her eyes went to the copy of Kevin Blake's book, which he'd given to her after our meeting. She handed it to me.
"This is yours, by the way. I got the paperback on Sunday."
"Any good?"
"Like the super said, he's not much of a writer. Felt like a police report crossed with a thesaurus. I couldn't get through it."
"The Sleepwalker," I said, reading the dust jacket. "Awakening the Beast." I put it down on the dashboard. "I can barely get through the title."
"I thought you were a big reader."
I looked at her and she shrugged.
"Your flat, the bookcases."
"Cheaper than insulation," I said, shutting the conversation down. "Look, once we get back to the station, I'd like you to liaise with DCI James and his team on the CCTV footage from St. Mary's. That's our best bet for solving this thing quickly." She looked at me, but didn't reply. "It might take a few days, sitting in with them if you're up for it."
"Sure," she said.
"And you should probably write up a report of what we got from Blake and Moore. Although I'm sure James is hot on our heels." She nodded. Pars couldn't complain if I entrusted a job like that to her, and it might give me some breathing room. I wanted to discourage Naomi from following up on the possibility that I'd been the intended target of the hit. Whether it was true or not, there was nothing good at the end of that thread for either of us. The scanner glitched into life, but she got to it before I did.
"Constable Black, receiving."
Her eyes lit up as dispatch relayed a possible sighting of the woman in the green tracksuit. She started up, switched on the sirens and made a U-turn. We were forging ahead, despite my best efforts.
Chapter 8
We found the Fiat that had been stolen from St. Mary's car park on Lower Ormond Street, a well-heeled part of town that was home to an art centre and walled in on both sides by red brick apartment blocks. It had been torched, implying that the woman I'd seen at the hospital had been in possession of it for a full 24 hours without being caught. Maybe she hadn't been quite as fried as she'd seemed. We arrived in time to see the fire brigade extinguishing the flames. An efficient means of wiping your fingerprints.
"Yeah," said the woman who called it in. "Green tracksuit. Looked all wrong round that car. Next thing I know, it's smoking." Did you notice if she was carrying anything? Asked Naomi. She closed her eyes. I think there was a backpack. Light-coloured, but minging. She the one off the news?
Sounds possible, said Naomi, making a note. Do you have any idea which direction she went in?
I was getting the kids together. Sorry.
We crossed the road and watched the fire brigade packing it up.
Clever girl, said Naomi, balefully.
She left a pause for me to contribute something. But I just watched the fire crew disassembling.
So, what do we do now? Look around?
She was trying to avoid me dumping her back at Central Park.
Where would we even start? I said.
We're a 2-minute walk from the busiest road in the city, at the busiest time. North, and you're at the station. Then anywhere. South, and you're at either of the universities. We can send some uniforms door to door, but the best we can hope for is which direction she went in.
It feels like we're 5 minutes behind her.
I suggest you make peace with that.
Ha, she said flatly. You're not interested in this, I started walking towards the car. At all, are you?
No one's interested in this, I said, without turning round. Every newspaper on the stand this morning says you're wrong. That press conference says you're wrong.
They're interested in some ghoul who went up in flames, not the truth behind it.
Good job we are then, she said, coming alongside me. Superintendent Pars said we should find this girl before the firearms unit.
Why was that?
If you were listening to Chase this morning, then I'm sure you can work it out.
But I'm wondering if you know.
Because they think she killed Rennick, I said, looking at Naomi. If they find her, they'll gun her down in the street.
And you're okay with that?
I've just been here before.
And where exactly is here?
On the losing side, Constable Black. Welcome aboard. Find her first and lock her up. They'll kill her in there instead. That's what they do.
Who's they?
I ignored her and turned for the car.
You went undercover, she said.
I stopped, and she spoke to my back.
Looking for police corruption, I heard.
I didn't say anything.
I take it you found it then?
I caught my reflection in the glass. Everywhere I looked. She was silent for a moment.
Fine, she said finally. That's them. We're talking about you. You're happy with them finding her first and shooting her down. A woman's death on your conscience.
What's one more of them? I said, opening the door and climbing inside the car. When I looked back at Naomi, she was staring straight ahead with a slight frown on her face, like the street was unfamiliar to her, and she was lost. I didn't meet her eye when she got into the car. She started up without saying anything, and I caught my reflection again in the wing mirror. Then I leaned back so I wouldn't have to see myself.
Chapter 9.
We didn't speak to each other on the drive back to police headquarters, and I was looking forward to breaking off from Constable Black, allowing her to be absorbed into the tedious due diligence of DCI James and his team. The first few hours of our partnership hadn't been promising. I knew most of that was down to my cynicism and lack of investment, but given the circumstances, those weren't personality traits I expected to change. For Naomi's part, her frustration with me presented itself in an abrupt, impatient driving style, punctuated with obscenities projected at her drivers.
"Get a life, dickhead!" she shouted at a man who cut her up.
When he stopped and tried to give her a menacing look, she held two fingers up to the windscreen, daring him to do something about it. He drove on. When we passed the station without stopping, I gave her a look.
"Where are we going, Constable?"
I thought... My phone started to vibrate against my chest.
"One second," I said,
pulling it from my jacket pocket and picking up the call.
"Aiden waits."
The woman said my name strangely, like it was an instruction for me to stay put.
"I'm looking for Aiden Waits."
"Speaking," I said. She started to say something else, but the line cut out, and I looked at the screen. It had come from a withheld number. I thought she'd sounded familiar somehow, but I couldn't place her. At length, my mind came back to where we were. This unexpected deviation.
"Well?"
I said, looking at Naomi. She nodded at the windscreen.
We're here.
We pulled into a side road in Newton Heath, not far from police headquarters. Naomi leaned out of the window and badged a constable in a filthy high-vis jacket. He waved us through and she coasted on to an enormous, abandoned-looking warehouse with a sign that read, Coleridge and White's. For a moment I thought this was the kind of place a killer might dump a body, another crime scene. But when she switched off the engine, I could hear gunfire.
Tell me you haven't arranged an interview with firearms on the shooting range.
I haven't, I promise.
I can hear them, Naomi.
Yeah, but they don't know we're here, she said, opening the door. Come on.
I thought about my new neighbor's question earlier in the day.
Which one of you's in charge, then?
Firearms units train at several remote sites in and around the city. This, I assumed, was one of them.
Louisa Yankovsky, said Naomi, as we approached the building.
The officer we believe to have been on duty when the photograph of Martin Wick was taken in St. Mary's.
I thought we could probably catch her off guard.
I'm not sure you want to surprise someone who's carrying an assault rifle. She winked at me.
That's why I brought my human shield.
Before I had a chance to laugh, a firearms officer stationed at the factory's entrance took a step towards us. He had a hipster beard that curled upwards, like it was climbing off his face, and I hated him on sight.
DC Black, said Naomi, holding up a card. This is DS Waits. We'd like to speak with one of your officers.
Sorry, sweetheart, he said, like he was talking to a 10-year-old child.
We only interrupt them if it's life or death.
We're in luck then, she said, because it's the latter.
Which death? He looked around between us and smiled.
Only we get so many.
We'd rather discuss that inside, said Naomi.
But if we need a fresh corpse...
He made a face and I broke in.
I know guard duty gets boring, Constable, but we're not here to chat. Someone put air vents in one of your colleagues in the early hours of Sunday morning and we're looking into it.
Rennick, he said darkly.
I nodded.
You could probably phrase that a little more tactfully, couldn't you?
Anything you say, sweetheart.
He glared at me.
Somehow, I can never tell men with guns what they want to hear.
Follow me, he said, hitting the F sound.
I only hope we find the fucker first.
Naomi raised an eyebrow. I thought I'd travelled in her estimation, but I couldn't tell whether I'd gone up or down.
Chapter 10.
We were led through into an enormous wide-open space. The walls were made of cinder block up to about 6 feet, and sheet metal thereafter. One benefit of catastrophic industrial decline was that it opened up plenty of ad hoc shooting ranges. The sound of gunfire was absolutely deafening. There were 6 firearms officers standing in formation with their backs to us, discharging their weapons into targets about 50 feet away. Standing at the rear was their sergeant, who frowned and removed his ear mufflers as we entered. He spoke to the man from the door, looked at us, and then nodded. One by one, the others ceased fire and turned, all except the lone female firearms officer, Louisa Yankovsky. She continued firing into targets, reloading and repeating, as if she were pushing back some unstoppable force. Finally, she sensed her colleagues looking at her, lowered her weapon and turned. I thought I saw a moment's flight in her eyes, an almost imperceptible step backwards, until she calculated the odds, removed her ear mufflers and came towards us. I recognized her from the ward. She'd signed me in and out several times whilst inside the hospital, but we'd never had much cause to talk. She was second or third generation Polish immigrant, I thought. The kind of bone structure, luminescent skin, and white teeth that rarely floated to the top of the city's gene pool. She was athletic and tall, at least my height. And as she drew closer, I saw that she was out of breath, sweating slightly. Alongside the firearm, it made her look strong and fearless.
Louisa, said her sergeant, these two officers would like a word with you.
Waits, she said, recognizing me from the ward. What's this about?
Perhaps we better talk outside, said Naomi.
You won't need the gun, I added. As we left the building, I saw the other officers exchanging looks. Louisa strode ahead of us, as if eager for confrontation. There, she went comfortably to the far side of the car we'd arrived in, leaning into the roof like she was wearing it as body armor. She'd been highly trained to find the best vantage points, and I wondered if that would be reflected in her conversation.
This about Rennick, she said.
We're sorry about your loss, Louisa.
Well, I think you're wasting your time here.
I was there when the attack took place, I said, hoping to find some common ground. Rennick was a good man. I hadn't known him personally, but maybe it was true. People seem to get a certain grace period immediately after death.
Tell me what happened.
I don't know, I said honestly.
But it's what we'd like to find out, Naomi resumed. Were the two of you close?
Close, said Jankowski. I think you know that's a loaded word between male and female officers. What about you two? Are you two close?
No,
said Naomi, more forcefully than I would have expected. Jankowski half laughed and nodded, looking down at her reflection in the car roof.
Well, me and Rennie were mates. I kept expecting him to walk through that door today. You were going pretty hard out there, said Naomi. Visualization. Thinking about the bitch who did him. What's going on with that, by the way? We've heard there's been a sighting of her, but then nothing.
We're not entirely sure she was even the attacker, said Naomi, her eyes drifting to me for support.
You what?
The situation's complicated by Martin Wick, I said. We're investigating his murder alongside Rennick's. Jankowski snorted.
Is that a problem? Said Naomi. Rennie deserves better. They're tied together now, and they always will be. It's disgusting.
She unballed her fists.
How does Wick's murder make things more difficult?
Naomi looked at me to answer, and I did it grudgingly. He muddies the waters of whatever the motive might be.
The motive? What else would it be but vigilantism? People hated him. That's why we were there in the first place.
There could be an unrelated issue, or there could be unanswered questions from his original conviction, I said, throwing out my two options. For all we know, one of the police officers on duty might have been the intended target. I felt Naomi's eyes move on and then off me. Jankowski thought about it and frowned.
So tell me how I can help.
Naomi took a notebook from her pocket.
You were working on Wick's protective detail in the weeks leading up to the attack. Did you see or hear anything unusual?
No, said Jankowski. I'd have reported it.
You think she'd been hanging round St. Mary's a while then? This tracksuit girl?
And the searches? Said Naomi, ignoring her question.
Were you satisfied with the rigor you applied to the sign-in procedure?
What are you saying? Naomi's voice remained steady. I'm asking if you were happy with the rigor you applied to the sign-in procedure.
Always, Jankowski said. Procedure's there for a reason. I can stop and search in my sleep, Constable Black. Can you? What's this got to do with someone stabbing Rennie? I wasn't even there.
Where were you, out of interest?
Her jawline tightened.
On duty.
Did you see yesterday's mail?
Jankowski shook her head, but I found it hard to believe. It was the biggest story of the day and affected her personally. I found myself looking at her a little more closely. Naomi opened the driver's side door and found a copy of Sunday's paper. She laid it on the roof with the picture of Wick facing up.
We have reason to believe that this photograph was taken while you were on duty, Louisa.
Jankowski leaned off the car roof and stood up to full height.
Bullshit, she said. I'm not the only guard he had for breakfast. You're the only one who was on duty when he...